Welcome to the Heartland Business Podcast, where we shine a light on the unique businesses that make Nebraska special and celebrate the grit, innovation, and heart that define our Midwest values. I'm your host, Michael Bollier, with Hamus Wealth Management at UBS in Omaha, Nebraska. Our team advises affluent families and business owners on complex wealth planning. We integrate investment strategy, tax efficiency, liquidity planning, and long-term legacy design into a coordinated plan. Our goal is simple: to bring clarity and structure to your financial life so that you can lead your businesses with confidence, unlock new opportunities, and focus more of your time on what matters most. You can learn more or connect with us anytime at advisors.ubs/hamus, or send us an email at hammeswm@ubs.com. On each episode, we sit down with Nebraska entrepreneurs to dive into three key areas: your product, your story, and your lessons. Let's get started. Our guest today is Sean Ilk. Sean is the CEO and president of Golden Sheaf Whiskey. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and his views are his own. Sean, thanks for coming in today. How are
Michael,
you doing?
Great. Appreciate you having me.
Awesome. Well, the pleasure is mine. So, Sean, the listeners have three main questions on this podcast. What is your product? What is your story? And what are your lessons? So I just want to jump right into just your product. Tell me about Golden Sheaf, and how did it start in the 1800s, and how has it evolved over the years?
Yeah, it's been quite a story for me personally. The irony is, I have never been a big drinker because I've been on digestive meds forever, so always have to watch the alcohol content. And unfortunately, I have no palate. So I would love to say I am some bourbon whiskey connoisseur. I'm able to tell every note, every scent, every whatever else. I can't. I've tasted a lot of bourbon the last few years, and it's been fun. But Golden Sheaf is really Nebraska's greatest secret, as you said. When it was first introduced to me, I kind of called BS because I think I know everything about Omaha. I know everything about Nebraska. And I had never heard of this, which made absolutely no sense. Golden Sheaf started. We had a huge distillery about a mile south of downtown that obviously is no longer. Golden Sheaf was the chief product. Started in 1866, a year before the state became a state, in March of 1867, I believe, and was a huge deal in the state. The distillery was top 10 distillery in the country. Again, nobody knows about. Golden Sheaf was a huge tax revenue generator before income tax went into play and so forth, and had a tremendous run. But the owners eventually diversified into cattle, one of the main reasons the Omaha Stockyards got to be the largest stockyard in the country. And so when Prohibition came along in 1920, booze obviously had a bad name, hence Prohibition. These guys were diversified, and they said, yep, it's been a good run. We'll just wrap it up. And the irony continued that the United States government came back to 8 or 10 distilleries and said, we would like you to stay open for medicinal purposes. And of course, every other one but these guys said, oh, that's fantastic. We're staying open. And they're like, we're good. So they're the only ones that declined the invitation to stay open during Prohibition. Wow. Because they had all these other things going and they had moved on. So that's why the brand just died over 100 years ago. And we revived it a few years ago. So we've put out 12 total products. I'm probably at the 10-yard line of our next product. And what's great about it is this year we are 160 years old when you do the math. So this will be our 160th anniversary release, and very excited. But as we will continue to discuss, there's so much more to all this than you would even think, even for an old business guy like myself. So,
yeah, awesome, awesome. Tell us about the products that you currently have.
We've done 12 thus far. I think probably 8 are sold out completely. So they have been a combination. We've done 3 straight bourbons, 2 straight ryes, And then everything else has been some sort of interesting blended series. So we had bourbon sit in a maple syrup cask for 6 months. So obviously you get those notes and the sweetness that comes from that. We've had bourbon and rye and white wine cask, red wine cask, those sorts of things. So that's been fun. But I think my main focus is we want a less expensive, straight bourbon product is going to be this year's product, and really focus on that and really focus on having that, get things on the track we want, and really looking to expand things here and in the region as we move forward.
Awesome. Awesome. Tell us more about kind of the blends. I know that you guys have the ability to do custom blends, and maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself, so apologies for that. But tell us a little bit about the custom blends that you're able to do.
Yeah, we've had a good partnership with Bardstown Bourbon Distillery in Bardstown, Kentucky, which is the home of bourbon. So Bardstown is a fascinating little big town, 35 miles south of Louisville. There's probably 30,000 people there, but there are a lot of millionaires, some billionaires down there. There is bourbon and whiskey everywhere. Us in the Midwest, we will sometimes get the smell of money coming from feedlots and whatever. The smell of money down there is about 8 times a day. There's a mash bill scent that just comes over the entire town and so forth. So it's a fascinating area, and it's really a fascinating industry. As a 30-year-plus attorney, 20-plus-year broker, serial entrepreneur, all the things, I've been involved in most industries one way or the other. And this industry is very interesting, that obviously a ton of competition, and everybody wants to win, but they don't want to kill you. They still want you to do okay because it's good for the industry.
Yeah.
And I've had some very high-level execs and connoisseurs and experts, they will say that. So there's kind of this different take on the entire industry that I've never seen in another. Almost all of the industries, we'd love to cut you off the knees and crush you and win and all the things. This, again, they want to win. They want to taste the best, make the most money, but they still want you to do pretty well. And I think that also kind of ties to some of my excitement the next few years that I have been bringing up to them. The bourbon trail in Kentucky is great and a great visit, even if you're not into whiskey and bourbon. A lot of fun. It's like Napa. I'm not a big wine fan, but I've been to Napa 3-4 times. It's awesome. Same for bourbon trail. But I've said, you guys should be supporting, and they do, and they're all in favor of it. But obviously, it's on me and others around the country. You should be extending the bourbon trail to Nebraska and Pennsylvania and Texas. I mean, why not? Again, good for the industry. So they all love the heritage brands and all these, the history, like we're talking about with Golden Chief. There's a lot of these historical stories tied to a lot of brands. Some have been revived, but some are still laying dormant, yet to be found at some point. But the history is a really big deal in the industry, much more than most as well.
Yeah. Tell us about that bourbon trail. Where is it, just in Kentucky, or you mentioned expanding it? What does that trail look like as of right now?
Yeah. The main bourbon trail, as it's known, is in Kentucky and really extends. There are hundreds of distilleries, but some huge distilleries from Jim Beam and Castle and Key. I'm just trying to think of all the ones, Woodford Reserve and Maker's Mark and all that. The stretch that I've experienced is really the 80-mile stretch between Bardstown, Louisville, and Lexington. And Louisville's also done a nice job, obviously. Bardstown is the home. Louisville, though, obviously, is smart enough to say, hey, let's capitalize on it, still in the region. So there's a lot of great stores there. There's a Whiskey Row that most of the large distillers have some sort of presence there. And so it is a great trip down there. And it's also part of the benefit that we have with our relationship with Bardstown Bourbon. I'm looking forward to doing Golden Chief VIP trips down there probably at least once a quarter, probably coming in on a Thursday, leaving Sunday. Obviously, Bardstown Bourbon will be a highlight, but we will hit a lot of other distilleries, areas, great food down there, and so forth. So it's a fantastic extended weekend trip for really anybody.
Yeah, that's awesome. How did you get involved with Bardstown?
Bardstown was really, we were looking at different opportunities, and obviously a very small brand, But kind of back to that attitude I had said before, one time we were down there bottling. We were bottling on a smaller line, and the John Wayne Duke brand, which is a pretty big brand, was being bottled next to us. We were doing like 3,000 bottles in a day, and they were doing 50,000 bottles over 2 days or something. And as a credit to Bardstown Bourbon, very impressed, again, as a business guy, an attorney, how they do business. That day, you wouldn't know if I was had ownership in Golden Sheaf or I was the president of the Duke brand.
Wow.
They treat everybody the same, and they've made it very clear to me from the beginning, and as we just did our new agreement, and that's going to extend us for another 4 or 5 years here, I will say at times, look, I know we're a small brand, and they always stop me. They're like, look, you are an official partner brand. We take that extremely seriously. Yes, there's a lot of bigger players and whatever. It's good for the industry. You're a client, and we're going to take care of you. So it's one of the things I've really appreciated in this endeavor. But again, as a business guy that has dealt with billionaires, the farmers, the whatever else, I like when people are treated the same and so forth. So it's one of the benefits of being tied to Bardstown.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I think just the concept of a rising tide lifts all boats is so unique in this day and age, which is exactly what you're saying. Could you talk a little bit about like today's market with, it seems like these influencers and professional athletes, they're always releasing their own type of tequila or whiskey or scotch or something like that.
Right. Well, I think obviously that's the beauty of being famous these days, from Kim K to whatever else. You can monetize yourself so many different ways. But I think this obviously is a very great opportunity for those folks. Plus, as I know, it's a lot of fun. I mean, there's so many things from a business standpoint that's very serious and whatever else. And sometimes I'm even asking myself, why do you still love this as much? And I'm much deeper from a time, money, energy perspective in this than I ever expected. But it is fun compared to, oh, we could go buy some stock and let's buy another real estate thing, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I think the combination of the fun aspect of it and then obviously the celebrity and whatever else, it's just a fantastic combination. And I know you're also thinking, the listeners and whatever else, there's always the question of why does something do well? Is it because it's the greatest taste you've ever had in your life? Or is it really good marketing? Or is it the bottle? Or is it... And the answer is everything. But the marketing is a much higher percentage, in my humble opinion, than probably most people think.
Yeah.
So when The Rock says you need to buy this tequila, well, if that's good enough for The Rock, then hey, whatever else. So hey, it's just a great combination for those folks to be able to move those brands.
Yeah. Have you thought of becoming an influencer or a professional athlete just to plug the brand?
I think I got some college eligibility. Maybe we'll do something. But no, I mean, we've had some of those conversations over time. Down the line, I think part of what I'm looking to do is, would it be great to be the next Jack Daniels and all that? Sure. Is it going to happen? Probably not. And that's okay. But at the end of the day, I want to move the brand forward. We can have a nice business, make solid money, even just right around here, let alone when we start expanding more into other states and mail order and all those sorts of things. There's a nice business to be had here. That do I think I'm going to become Elon Musk with Golden Sheaf? No, but solid business. But the other part is, and I think this is a part that more and more people are realizing, no matter what you're doing, is, again, I'll be very honest with you, I've made no money in Golden Sheaf, but I have made six figures from relationships I've met through Golden Sheaf and bourbon that come back to me as a lawyer, consultant, real estate guy, business broker, insert all the commas tied to all of my stuff. I think that's another huge benefit to it. And that was one of the things that was attractive to me early on of why this is so attractive to really, in my view, everyone. You have a lot of people that are really into whiskey and bourbon and they take it very seriously and they know their stuff. There's a lot of people that kind of act it because they think maybe it's cool. There's other people that I don't like it at all, but my dad or my aunt. And then the last, well, there's more, but the other big piece, and this is a huge focus of mine, just again, as a business guy, I saw the attractiveness of this to be able to sell it corporate. I mean, what a great corporate gift, prospect, employee, instead of an Amazon gift card or Applebee's or, you know, whatever. Hey, here's this local 160-year-old da-da-da-da-da and doing some of the specialties and labeling and gift combinations. To me, that is going to be the main way, because it's great to sell one bottle at a liquor store, but from a business perspective, it's better to sell 50 to your local financial advisor or real estate team or CPA or whoever. And I have more and more people chomping at the bit in that regard. And that's also one of the reasons we're coming in with this next product at a price point that's going to be attractive to those folks as well.
Awesome. That gets me to my next question, which I should have asked far earlier, so I apologize for that. Where can people find Golden Chief and how do they get involved with
the group? So one, liquor stores around Nebraska, I'm on Lincoln, most still have some of the stock. We now can sell bottles direct out of our event center tasting room with our liquor licensing out there, so out near Oakview Mall in West Omaha. We have a small distribution agreement in Kentucky, so you can find Golden Chief in a few Kentucky stores. And then right now, we've got an online relationship with sealbox.com that you can order bottles through there. And we will be expanding that more, both out of our event center, but then also from an online presence. I will say, as a lawyer, I knew a very small amount of liquor law. I know a lot more now today. It's still not enough. That's why I have a local Nebraska counsel, Kentucky counsel. There's a lot to it. This isn't selling Sock of the Month Club. So you can't just say, hey, I'm shipping my bottles nationwide. It's approval here, and then it's approval in individual states, and on and on and on. There's a lot to it.
A lot of red tape. Well, yeah. I like to say the attorney's got to get paid somehow, but you are an attorney.
Again, as God intended, that's fine. But now when I'm on this side in an area that is brutal to deal with, yeah, I'm hating it many times, but it is what it is.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in your opinion, how important is packaging in marketing? You talked about the importance of marketing. Tell me about that importance of packaging, especially in such a high class product.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, obviously it's important, but when you get into the nuances of it, it's the glass, the actual bottle you're selecting. It is the labeling. It is every little detail of the label and so forth. So on this topic, a good chunk of time of mine of the last 2-3 weeks is I got 5 different bottle options that got shipped up from Kentucky, and I've gotten lots of input and whatever else. We have an initial selection for the glass, and then lots of conversation with the artist we're going to move forward with to resize and update and everything with the labeling, and then lots of conversations with our printing partner out of Portland, Oregon, on what are we doing. And I think one of the things that I really like about what we've done is we have only found 2 of the original bottles from the 1800s. And our current label is just a modernization of that label that was used 160 years ago.
Wow.
So it's great to tie that in. It's also great to talk about. And it really kind of blows everybody's minds when they see probably the one picture I've shown more than any in the last few years is the old bottle. And then you flip to the new bottle and you just see the commonality of it. But also we found a schematic from the Nebraska archives of the old distillery, and that's on the front of the bottle. It was then, it is today. Again, it just ties into all of it. So, of course, I'm biased, but I think we have one of the best labels out there. But the glass has been just one of those things you take for granted. It has been a challenge over the years. What is available? How much? Mm-hmm. And now, shipping from out of country, how long does that take? And then tariffs, and then on and on. And again, when I'm buying 10 or 15,000 bottles, that might sound like a lot. It's not a lot in the industry. So again, I can't just call up and say, hey, please move Maker's Mark to the side while I get whatever I want.
Yeah.
At some point, it'd be great. And you see a lot when you go to liquor stores, a lot of those bottles are specially designed bottles. So at some point, it would be great to have our own specific bottle and so forth. But to do that, design, molds, minimum buy, it's probably $100,000 just to get your own bottle made.
Wow.
So yeah. I'm not willing to sell a kidney yet to get that bottle. So we're going to use one of the 25 stock bottles that's used for a lot of spirits right now.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Cool. Well, with that, let's start to kind of transition over to your story.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how you started with Golden Sheaf in the first place. Tell us about some of your other business ventures that you currently do.
Yeah, it's been a pretty wild 25 years, to be honest with you. I started as a finance guy, undergrad, University of Nebraska, was so excited to go work for a bank in Minneapolis. I wanted to wear my suit and tie and go to my skyscraper, and banking was going to be exciting. And with apologies to all my banking friends, I think 2 or 3 months in, I was having trouble getting up out of bed, and my now ex-wife was like, "You feel okay?" And I'm like, "I can't believe how much I can't stand this already." So got my MBA at Drake in Des Moines, came back here for law school. Never thought I'd practice law. Just thought I'd go back into business with that combination. And started clerking for a medium-sized firm here in town. And I'm like, this isn't a bad gig. Money solid, got a lot of freedom, flexibility. And I think now people of your generation understand the freedom and flexibility. 30 years ago, that was such a shocking new thing and whatever, and I just gravitated for it. I mean, how do I get that? That freedom is as important than money or anything else, and that, I think, is one of the keys to life. And I probably still think that's the number one key to life. So ended up becoming a partner in a law firm. And enjoyed that time, great experience doing all the things. But after about 6-7 years, I was thinking, okay, I'm helping a lot of people do stuff. I think I want to do the stuff myself. So when the opportunity came up in 2000, dating myself, a tech firm in town, Inicom, was this great Nebraska, Omaha story, but started falling apart. I got with these guys. I'm like, look, I don't know anything about this or whatever else. But as a bankruptcy financial workout attorney, one of my 5-7 specialties, I mean, is there not something we can do with this? You can always go get another job. Again, I'm anti, you know, get another job. And so that's what we did. So that started a 11-12 year wild ride that we started, I don't know, 10 different firms, all sorts of tech. Data centers was the main thing that made the money that we sold for a nice chunk of change back in late 11. But we were the first Huskers.com. We were streaming games through our data centers, helped run a software company. We bought motorcycle dealerships. I mean, it was like something new every 6 months, which has really led to what Sean is used to for ever since. So obviously addicted to the variety. But at real estate, I was just got my license just so I could get referral fees because I was always sending somebody referrals out. And I've sold $1 billion of real estate or handled that amount of transactions. But there's always been a couple startups going. And that's really how Bourbon came to me as a reputation as a startup expert. I'm not totally sure if I deserve that or not. But that's how I got introduced to Bourbon, needing help in that regard. And as I told you when we first sat down or getting ready to sit down, there's two new ventures going now. Again, both got referred to me because of the experience, reputation, and so forth. There's not a lot of people that can, and again, I love everyone. I love all professional advisors and especially lawyers and whatever else, but there's not a lot of people that can give you the summary I just gave you. There's not a lot of people and not a lot of attorneys that can say we started in 2000, we sold for $110 million. Don't get too excited. I didn't get retired on Desert Island money or anything. There's a lot of people to pay. But that reputation and that experience has really led me into some really interesting ventures, including Bourbon. So
yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like you've made a lot of unique partnerships down the road. Is that fair to say? How do you come across these partnerships? How do you vet a partnership?
Yeah, it's an important question because, again, as a lawyer that's probably helped, I don't know, 2,000 people get started in some regards, everybody comes to me and they're all excited and they're all, it's the greatest idea since sliced bread and we're going to make $1 billion. And I want to hear all that. I love that. but I also get paid to tell you what you need to hear, maybe not just what you want to hear. So I want to hear their excitement and all the positive. But, and it's funny, I had this conversation this morning, a few hours ago, that I also come back and say, I have two questions for you. The first question is, okay, I got all the positive. Tell me the negative, worst case scenario. And I get deer in headlights looks. This has never even crossed their mind 95%. I mean, I'm stunned. And I'm like, well, I don't know, we could lose a lot of money. We could lose the house. And I'm like, okay, that's question one. Question two, can you live with that? Because if you can't, you probably should leave. If you can, then let's go. This is not all sexy, fun, whatever else. Starting a business is difficult. Scaling and growing is five times more difficult. And that's the other gut punch that a lot of people, they get to a year or two and they kind of think they've made it or they've crossed the finish line. And I'm like, okay, you kind of just got started.
Yeah.
Where are you taking this? Are you happy with this two-year run? Well, no. Okay, well, now it gets harder.
Yeah.
So that's the part of this that, again, I've been down that road so many times, not only hundreds or thousands of clients, 10, 20 plus times myself, either by myself or with partners, and getting back to your partner question, I think you just got to be really honest about, just because it's your brother or just because it's your elementary school friend, what it does not mean he or she will be a great business partner. And again, I know up front, it's like, oh, this is great, we're all in, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Unfortunately, a high percentage of time, 3, 6, 18 months down the line, my elementary kickball buddy really dropped the ball and really didn't back up what he said, or he got busy, whatever the case may be. So I think really sitting down and having a hard look and discussion, is this going to work? Are you really in? What do you bring into the table? Is it money? Is it skill? Is it time? Whatever it is, that conversation needs to be had, and conversations, I should say, not just one. And that's why I am brutally honest, open kimono, so to speak. Whenever I start a business with people, I tell them my net worth, I tell them whatever. I mean, this is partner, like marriage, whatever you want to say. We're in it to win it, and hiding things and this and that, or not thinking something's important, or in my view, doesn't work, because that stuff always comes up, especially if there's some problems that is going to affect everyone. So this might have been your problem last year. It's going to be our problem 2 years from now when it rears its ugly head and all that sort of stuff. So it's difficult. Obviously, it's great to have partners. You can spread the wealth, spread the work, all the things. But again, you got to be at least halfway close for as long as you possibly can in terms of the focus, the dedication, whatever else, because obviously there's going to be conflict if one person thinks they're doing 115% and the other guy's at 15%.
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. People can get in a lot of trouble with faulty relationships that they think are solid personally.
And right.
Once you get business involved, it's just a completely different ballgame.
Yep.
If you wouldn't mind, you've worked with tons of different industries. Tell me, is there a specific time that there was a product or a business that you thought, man, this one, I'm going to go in skeptical, but this one should blow it out of the water?
Yeah.
And then it didn't. Do you have an example like that?
Unfortunately, too many. I have a file somewhere that probably is full of stock options, member interest agreements, debentures, I mean, whatever, of all of these ventures. Again, I wouldn't get involved if I didn't think it had some potential. But now in your 50s, after going through everything I've been through, much more skeptical than I was 25 years ago of like, oh my God, it's the greatest thing ever, so on and so forth. I'm still going to lean on the positivity and whatever. But again, whether it's a client or partner or whatever, again, back to being brutally honest about it and say, hey, you gave me these financial projections. Yeah, I'm going to cut them by a third at least. And you gave me your expenses. We're going to pump those up by 50%, on and on and on. Again, I'm a finance guy to begin with. I mean, off the top of my head, there was two or three software companies that looked spectacular and could and shouldn't have been. But again, back to some of the mistakes we had. People didn't listen. You didn't get proper advice. You didn't take the advice. There were more scabs tied to the situation than it looked like up front. Unfortunately, I'm a problem solver, and I can fix 99%+ of whatever. But sometimes some of these founders have made so many mistakes, and they're in such a hole, you really can't recover. And there's a couple that come to mind, can't mention names, obviously, but exactly that. If they would have come to me earlier, Sean and these people would have a lot more money right now. But it just, again, too many mistakes, too much debt, on and on.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get into your lessons, but one other follow-up that I had is talk about the difference between, or the perceived difference that I have between a founder and a CEO. Mm-hmm. It seems like most businesses, they're in founder mode, and then eventually they kind of get over this hump into the CEO mode. Tell us about that.
Well, it's not only mode, it's two or more clear roles. And I think it kind of comes back to a couple of things we've touched on. You as the founder, hopefully can be honest with yourself enough and say, hey, I was the visionary. I came up with this idea. I ran this because there's nobody else and we didn't have the money to pay anybody. Well, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, or I've hit my cap. I need to bring in some experience and some C-level folks and so forth. The CEO, in your example, purely could be an employee. Now, again, if he or she is smart, they're going to get some ownership and options and all that sort of stuff. But you're hiring an operator. You're hiring that person to take you from here to here and all those sorts of things. Unfortunately, there's a lot of founders, or they'll say, well, it was my idea. And then the venture capitalists and the investment bankers or me is like, okay, that's cool. That doesn't mean you can be COO, CFO, on and on. Love ya. And you get some ownership or whatever. That doesn't mean you are God's gift to being a president or whatever else. And that's a tough conversation.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. Let's pivot into your lessons. I hope we're not running too long here.
Sure.
But tell me, what advice would you give a 20-year-old starting a business?
I think, and again, great question, and I love that. I've spoken a lot, high school, college. I was a professor at the University of Nebraska at times, and I was always a great student and sharp guy and whatever. I wish a couple 50-year-olds came in and said, yeah, you're not as smart as you think you are and all those sorts of things. Or here's some tricks of the trade that you're not going to learn in finance 403 and that sort of stuff. So I think a big part of it is, one, get some help. Get some true advisors, and it starts with the 2-3 attorney, CPA, and maybe somebody in the industry with some experience is going to specifically help you. I'll come back to the CPA. As a good, overconfident, 50-whatever guy, attorney, I'm not afraid of anything or anyone on planet Earth except the SEC and the IRS. So we're going to do everything as well as we can and get as much help as we can in that regard. Also, just because you think something is spectacular doesn't mean they, the public, is. I mean, there's case studies written out there of the greatest idea ever, da-da-da-da-da, and it just totally fell flat. People are like, oh, cool idea, I'm not buying that.
Yeah.
Or the opposite. Fred Smith started FedEx, and everybody says the dumbest thing ever, and he dies worth $10 billion or whatever it is. So, again, just being honest with yourself about you, what you bring to the table, your idea, but getting help and getting input on whatever you want to try to see if somebody's going to be attracted to it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Next question is, how has the Omaha business community evolved over the last decade? Or what makes Omaha a good place for a startup or for a new business?
Yeah, it's a great question. Omaha, to me, is one of the hidden gems in the United States. The number of people that have come here, or I have got them here for a reason, that come away because I think they think this is horse and buggy still and two streetlights and whatever, and they leave going, I cannot believe how nice this place is. Just in general. let alone how nice the Nebraska nice people are, let alone from a business perspective. So I will give you an example. I had investment bankers that were looking at buying a business here in town, private equity roll-up, which obviously is very popular these days. And everything's going real well. And all of a sudden, they're like, Sean, we're just going to stop everything just because the Midwest and Central Midwest was not on our bingo card for now. And I'm like, well, you guys are dumb. And we kept working them and lobbying them and whatever else. And it got to the point of, come here for a day. I will pay for it if I have to. Just give me a day. I'm a good sales guy. I'm a good speaker. You know, I'm schmoozy, but just come here. And they did. And they bought the business I wanted them to buy. And they are the biggest Omaha fans you're ever going to see. So that is a constant. As it's evolved, I think everybody in town, business leaders, community, even the government, I always hate to compliment the government, but I think they've done a pretty good job in the last 30 years, really, making Omaha better. You had to revitalize downtown. I'm a little biased. I live downtown, but Hal Dobb, who I interned with in Washington, D.C. long, long ago when he was a congressman, former mayor, he really lost re-election because he got the convention center and arena built. Well, thanks, Hal, for getting that done, because that has really been the centerpiece. Redo new baseball stadium for College World Series, you know, on and on and on. So I think the downtown has been a big part. I think the tax incentives over time have been helpful. It's just a pretty good pro-business environment, and people appreciate living here. They appreciate it being a nice place. They appreciate the fact that good schools are another pillar, you know, on and on and on. So it's just really a great combination as part of my sales pitch all the time of what a great combination of fantastic economy the last 30 plus years, low cost of living, housing, spend $1 million for a starter house, schools, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. You said something just now about when you're brokering some of these transactions, it sounds like you have some relationships with private equity firms that might not necessarily be in the Nebraska area. First question is, I mean, I guess, is that correct?
And yes.
How did you cultivate those relationships and how have those evolved over the years?
Well, I think it starts here. We have a pretty good undiscovered country, so to speak, of angel investors, some private equity, and that sort of stuff. So that's great. But yes, when you start to get into some bigger numbers or different industries or whatever the case may be, you're going to run into people all over the place. So I think there's not a lot of benefits to getting old. One of it is we've met thousands of people over time, hopefully made a good impression on the great majority of them. I've done pretty much anything, been around the block a few thousand times. And so I normally have the ability to either get in the door with somebody, or I know somebody that can get me in the door, the Kevin Bacon 6 degrees thing. Yes. And I think people are much more open to that, especially if you can show that you bring some background and some juice and this isn't your first rodeo and that sort of thing. So I think the other part is money people are always looking in the future. And so anytime you, and most people don't, in my opinion, and they need to, especially with everything that's going on now, when you show that you are also looking five steps ahead and say, hey, don't take Nebraska for granted. Don't take this for granted. Or, hey, have you ever thought of whatever? Hey, do you know what a data center is? They like to hear that because they get the same pitches over and over and over again. And even if they've always done well with it and whatever, it's like, okay, what else? So I think that's just part of it, that you can get in, or at least with some help, and I'll help bridge that gap as well at times, to be able to come at and be able to talk the talk, show you've done some stuff and whatever else, but also appreciate where you're at. I've had times where I can tell a 20-year-old might just call up somebody in Boston and act like da-da-da, and they're like, what? Okay, thanks for calling. You know, back to get some help, get some guidance.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Sean, this has been fantastic. I could sit here and talk about this for hours. Unfortunately, I don't think we have the listeners for that long, unfortunately. Yeah. So leave us with just kind of a final, tell us about all the services that you offer, mm-hmm. just kind of sum them up, and how do people get in contact with you?
Yeah, we are really a rarity of a one-stop shop between legal, residential, commercial real estate, business brokering, so buying, selling, transitioning business. Obviously, there's a number of other specific firms we get involved in, but everybody should be buying bourbon one way or the other, whether you like it or somebody around you, or again, it is a fantastic client gift, prospect gift, conversation piece. On that specific, I tell my team, everybody's tired of being sold. Can I be your lawyer? Can I list your house? Can I list your business? Can I be your financial advisor? Whatever the case may be, build the relationship first, however you do it. And one of the things that I have enjoyed, like I said before, and it's been very successful for me personally, bourbon or an experience tied to it is a way to start the relationship and then go win them over or go sell them later. I think everybody is next level tired of being pitched. We've got to mix it up. You've got to differentiate yourself.
Absolutely. And how do people get in contact with you?
You can check out personal website, shawnbusiness.com. That's S-H-A-W-N. You can call me direct. I still answer the phone, 402-598-4002 or shawn@goldensheaf.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been awesome. Yeah, couldn't thank you enough. We'll have you on next time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
Right, thanks, Sean. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Heartland Business Podcast. If you want to find out how we can help you or your family maximize your wealth, please visit our website or send us an email at hammeswm@ubs.com. Alternatively, if you or someone you know has a compelling local business story that would be good for the podcast, please send us an email.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.